in the Comedy Club.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, we continue the story of the life of Violet Gibson, who at the age of 50, in 1926, raised her hand and fired a revolver at the fascist leader of Italy. Francis Stonor Saunders' account, The Woman Who Shot Mussolini, is read by Sinead Cusack.
The Honourable Violet Gibson, daughter of Lord and Lady Ashbourne, was not expected to do much. Her life, as the daughter of Ireland's preeminent statesman, was a genteel, sequestered existence, far removed from the blood and mire of Irish politics and the subsistence conditions in which most of the population lived. The Gibsons lived in a beautifully appointed Georgian house in Merrion Square, a coveted address for Dublin's elite. Violet's father, Edward, had been born here in 1837, the son of a wealthy solicitor. There was a family fortune, accumulated over the four centuries since the Gibsons, English Protestants, had settled in County Meath. In 1868, Edward Gibson had married the 19-year-old Frances Collis. In that year, she produced his heir, William, followed by seven children within a decade: Henry, known as Harry, Elizabeth, as Elsie, Edward, Ernest, known by his second name, Victor, Francis, Violet, known as Visey, born in 1876, and finally Constance. In 1872, Gibson's father died, leaving him a very rich man. In 1875, at the age of 37, he was returned to the House of Commons as the Conservative member for the University of Dublin. From this moment, Edward Gibson became a prominent figure in public life. In 1885, he was elevated to the peerage as the first Baron Ashbourne upon his appointment as Lord Chancellor of Ireland. He was swift to make his mark with the Land Purchase Act, which conferred on Irish tenants opportunities of purchasing their holdings on favourable terms. Ashbourne had his detractors, of course, those who refused to concede that the Crown had the right to gift what didn't belong to it. Within Ashbourne's own family, the tension developed into a painful and unresolvable conflict, for prominent among those who disagreed with him was his own son and heir, Willie, as decided in his Irish nationalism as the father was in his unionism. Willie loathed British rule. Gibson was a thoroughly domesticated man, devoted to his wife and children. But events often forced the family to separate. Reunions were joyous but emotionally tumultuous affairs, his presence inextricably associated with his absence. Of all the children, Violet seems to have adopted the most striking strategies for dealing with this ambivalence. She showed signs, even as a little girl, of a peculiar temperament, her younger sister Constance remembered. She was hysterical and impatient of restraint, would fly into the most awful tempers over the least trifle, and often lost control of herself. Violet may have learned to stamp her feet to get attention, but she also learned the ways befitting of a young honourable, the title she acquired aged 9 when her father became a peer. She was a beautiful girl, very finely built, with pre-Raphaelite features, diminutive proportions. Her adult height was 5 feet 1 inch, and thoughtful grey eyes. She sang well and loved art, both interests that she had the leisure to indulge. The principal aspiration for Lord Ashbourne's daughters was that they should marry well and thus consolidate the family's Anglo-Protestant respectability. In this, Elsie and Frances both proved high achievers. Unmarried daughters were expected to stay at home and look after their parents, a role the youngest daughter, Constance, true to her name, or perhaps hostage to it, assumed with disciplined devotion. Violet, determined to escape either destiny, was to take an altogether different path. The training for these roles was simple. Education at home until the age of 12, reading, not too much, as this could create an excess of independent thought, languages, social graces. A well-executed curtsy went a long way, as did a firm but good manner with servants. Unlike her sisters who enjoyed strong constitutions, Violet was an extremely frail child. Her illnesses, scarlet fever at 5, prolonged peritonitis at 14, pleurisy at 16, rubella at 20, made her different, set her apart from her siblings, creating the expectation that hers was to be a life of the swoon and the chaise longue. On the 1st of February, 1866, an American woman slipped and fell on an icy pavement in New Hampshire. Her name was Mary Baker Eddy, and she was to identify this event as the inauguration of Christian Science. The truth that struck her on the icy pavement was that illness didn't actually exist. Sickness, death, and even the body were only imagined. Eddy claimed to have the power of healing, called divine science, though she never provided any tangible proof of it. But the idea that illness was an illusion that could be dispelled by mental adjustment and discipline in the form of daily prayer and exercise was a compelling incentive for many, especially women whose chief experience of life was one of lassitude, of lying about with folded hands, cosseting their listless or recalcitrant bodies. Violet's mother, Lady Ashbourne, became an ardent follower. The peculiar mélange of Protestantism and Christian Science was accommodated in the Ashbourne household without strain. Violet, with her depressing resume of maladies, seemed an ideal recruit. But the much-vaunted health benefits didn't materialize for her, and she found the whole atmosphere surrounding Christian Science insufferable. In time, she would remove herself from her family in order to get away from it. Violet's flight from Mary Baker Eddy's cult took her towards another spiritual leader, Helena Blavatsky, the charismatic founder of Theosophy. With its almost limitless claims to be the touchstone for the hidden phenomena of life, Theosophy readily serviced the suggestible, the hysterical, the unhinged. But it is also true that not all its adherents fit this stereotype. Many embraced its concrete aim of building a universal brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. In this, Theosophy answered to Violet's philosophical and political consciousness that, owing much to Willie's influence, was taking shape as a form of ethical socialism. On the 28th of July, 1902, buried deep in a lengthy column in the Times titled Ecclesiastical Intelligence, is the announcement that Violet Gibson had become a Catholic. She was 26. Thereafter, and as a direct consequence of this decision, her appearances in the society columns of the Times would be few. Indeed, until she shot Mussolini in 1926, there was to be very little about her that was deemed worth mentioning. In the contemporary vernacular, Violet's was not a conversion, but a perversion, as in turning the wrong way, a usage not necessarily linked to sexual deviance at that time, though in the context of attacks on Catholics, it often was. Violet's decision to embrace the Catholic Church was heavily influenced by her brother Willie, who had converted in 1890 while at Oxford University. Willie's parents, though dismayed at his conversion, persisted yet in tolerating him in their world. Such leniency, while it lasted, was surprising. The Anglo-Irish elite was historically reluctant to compromise with Catholics. But Willie was the Ashbourne heir, and perhaps his parents maintained the hope that he would eventually fulfill their expectations. There was no quarter given to Violet, who was placed square in an agonizing predicament. Writing to her father, she described the painful and protracted difficulties that attended her decision. For a whole year I've been bothering myself over religion and can now see no way out of becoming a Catholic. In a rare confession of her wounds, she added, "Nobody realized that I was in any trouble and required care. I can't bear to talk of that dreadful time of loneliness and weakness." Religion can act as a psychological prop, a compensation for rootlessness and emotional disarray, and Violet certainly had experience of this. Her attempts, sometimes melodramatic, the temper tantrums as a child, to attract her father's love, may have been displaced into a different paternal relationship, in place of affiliation with God as father. But there was also an intellectual hunger for a substantive truth, one that superimposed on intense personal cravings a set of non-negotiable obligations. Lord Ashbourne was not, would never be, persuaded. His disapproval was deep and abiding. Violet's mooring knots were slipped, her safe anchorage in the Anglo-Irish ascendancy severed. The private income Violet received from the age of 21 had enabled her to travel and live independently in lodgings in London or abroad. Her various addresses can be traced through Lord Ashbourne's notebooks. In 1902, the year of her conversion, he scribbled her address as Villa Prairion, Coppet, Lake Geneva. When Violet arrived in the dreary lakeside village of Coppet, in nearby Geneva, a young man was sleeping rough on park benches, in a packing case under a bridge, in a public lavatory, finding precarious work as a builder's labourer, or butcher's or wine seller's boy. His name was Benito Mussolini. Born in 1883 in the Romagna village of Dovia, Benito was the son of a blacksmith and a schoolteacher. At school, he was deemed violent and uncontrollable and was eventually expelled. Notwithstanding these experiences, or perhaps because of them, he became a schoolmaster. His collar was nearly always dirty, his shoelaces undone, his hair long and unwashed. Pupils remembered him as Il Tirano, banging his fist on the desk and swearing at them. Some of them thought he was mad. In 1902, aged 19, he went to Switzerland, a move which allowed him to escape military service. Much of Benito's time there was spent with socialists and anarchists. State authorities were his natural enemies. He was threatening and abusive enough to be arrested and thrown into police cells, and after one 10-day spell in jail, was unceremoniously dumped on the Italian side of the border. He made his way back again and fell ill, very likely from hunger and the loneliness of exile. He read voraciously, a surfeit of Kropotkin, Marx, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Blanqui, Kant, Sorrel, Hegel, Spinoza, all devoured impatiently, haphazardly, so that his philosophical views were always the reflection of the book he had happened to read last. A Ukrainian socialist, Angelika Balabanov, who took Mussolini under her wing at that time, commented, "No one could see in this bewildered and neurotic youth of 20 the man who was to rule Italy." And nobody could have known that the young Anglo-Irish aristocrat Violet Gibson, also exiled in Switzerland, also lonely, also traversing difficult terrain of philosophical inquiry and personal truth, would one day try to kill him.
Tomorrow, Sinead Cusack reads part 3 of The Woman Who Shot Mussolini by Frances Stoner Saunders. It's abridged and produced by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, I'm Steve Urquhart. Ruth has a big choice to make. Social acceptance or personal pride? Laura Rees and Rory Kinnear star in our classic drama next. And later we begin a powerful series of dramas this week all about memory. The first is about a musician who can't recall his son's name, and yet his days on the road are remembered in vivid detail. Unforgettable is at 9:15 tonight. So now let's return to the story of Ruth by Elizabeth Gaskell, first published in 1853. It's about Ruth Hilton, a young orphan who caught the eye of a gentleman, Henry Bellingham. When she lost her job as a seamstress, it was he who came to her rescue, but then he left her and their child, Leonard. And now, oh look, he's back.
We present Anne Reed, Anton Lesser, and Rory Kinnear in Ruth by Elizabeth Gaskell, dramatised by Ellen Dryden, with Laura Rees as Ruth. Episode 3.
The postboy's just brought these letters for you, ma'am.
Thank you, Nellie. Miss Benson. And the other a hand I do not recognise. No name, no initials, no greeting.
For our child's sake, and in his name, I summon you to appoint a place where I can speak and you can listen undisturbed. The time must be on Sunday. The limit of distance may be the circumference of your power of walking. My words may be commands, but my fond heart entreats. More I shall not say now, but remember your boy's welfare depends on your according to this request. Address BD... Post Office, Eccleston.
Should I answer this, or throw it away? No. I must know everything, the best and the worst. I must not neglect anything that comes to me in my child's name. The sands below the rocks where we met you the other night. Time afternoon church.
My own Ruth, this is kind. What, Ruth, have you no word for me?
I have nothing to say. I do not want explanations. We must not speak of the past. You asked me to come in Leonard's, in my child's name, to hear what you have to say about him.
But what I have to say about him relates even more to you. And how can we talk about him without remembering the past? That past, which you try to ignore, I know in your heart you can't do it, is full of happy memories for me.
I was happy. I do not deny it.
And yet we are not to revisit the past. Why not? If it was happy at the time, is the recollection so miserable to you?
Do not touch me. I came to hear what you have to say about my child.
Our child, Ruth.
What have you to say about him?
Much that may affect his whole life, but it all depends on whether you will listen or not.
I am listening.
Oh, good God, Ruth, you'll drive me mad. How changed you are from the sweet, loving creature you were. I wish you were not so beautiful. Very well, will you hear me if I speak of the boy? A boy of whom any mother, any parent might be proud. Ruth, I have seen him. He looked like a prince in that cramped, miserable house. It is shameful that he should not have every kind of opportunity laid open before him. Oh, Ruth, I love you so. I cannot live without you. I offer you my heart, my life. I offer to place Leonard wherever you would have him placed. I have the power.